From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
Trump care is dead again, shivved by John McCain, who returned to the Senate just days ago to keep it alive. Where does Obamacare go next, and what should we make of the three Senate Republicans who saved it? Reince Priebus is out, just days after the new White House communications director threatened him and his colleagues publicly and in very vulgar terms. I'll talk with the reporter who heard all the juicy insults. Plus, Trump tweeted a surprise ban on transgender service in the military, but so far the Pentagon says it's ignoring him. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in this hour, Susan Hennessy of Brookings will tell us what laws can stop Trump from interfering in the Russia investigation, and the pollsters will assess whether Democrats have found a winning message for 2018. All that plus Steve Bannon's yoga routine up ahead. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jamil Smith, political journalist and contributing writer at The Daily Beast. And our special guest is Olivia Nuzzi. She's Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. We will get to all the infighting in the Trump administration, the president's continued war on his own attorney general, his Twitter order for transgender people to leave the military that the Pentagon is so far disregarding, and his communications director's assertion that Steve Bannon is trying to engage in some anatomically improbable sex acts. But first, the most drama I've ever seen on the Senate floor early Friday morning, John McCain's shocking vote to kill the latest version of Trump care. It had been a weird day in the Senate. Mitch McConnell was pinning his hopes on a bill called Skinny Repeal, aimed at undoing just a few provisions of Obamacare that are widely hated among Republicans, like the individual mandate. Senator Lindsey Graham got up at a press conference and called Skinny Repeal terrible policy that would wreak havoc in the insurance markets. And he declared that he would vote for it, so long as he got sufficient assurance that the House wouldn't act on it and let the president make it law. Later in the day, he said he got that assurance, but John McCain was unconvinced and he joined two moderate Republican women, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, who have been standing against the bill for weeks, sending it down to defeat 49-51. Olivia, how did this happen?
Well, I think that they were clearly unprepared. I mean, they put the vote up with Mitch McConnell put the vote up when he shouldn't have. And I just don't think that they really knew what they were getting into here. I think nobody really anticipated John McCain doing what he did. And I saw you talking about it, I think, on Twitter. People have been sort of trying to downplay. You know, certain people on the left have been sort of trying to downplay what he did by saying that it's somehow sexist to commend him for his vote. And I just think that is completely ludicrous. Nobody was expecting that. I think it kind of took everyone's breath away. And it's so funny to go back now and to look at Donald Trump's tweet thanking John McCain, who he had previously dinged for not being a war hero, for coming back to vote when it turned out the way that it did, which is in a way that obviously does not behoove the president and his administration. I mean, they have no legislative victories so far. And this is a very difficult week for them for a number of other reasons. And so I think that this was a huge hit for them.
Jamil, as Olivia alludes to, John McCain had come back to the Senate earlier in this week and given this long speech about the importance of regular order and how the process for this bill had been so atrocious. But then McCain had also voted to proceed on the bill, and a lot of people were sort of writing him off as a hypocrite, a grandstander, someone who poses as a maverick but isn't really. What do you make of the fact that he actually came through and at least for now seems to have provided the deciding vote to kill this thing?
I'm thankful that the branding finally lived up, to the hype. I think that he did what any decent human being would do when confronted with such terrible legislation that hadn't been debated, hadn't been discussed, hadn't been revealed to the American people. And I think, Republicans should not get extra credit for doing the right thing. We should not forget that Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski were against this from the very start. So I think calling it sexist to highlight John McCain over them, I think maybe goes a little bit far. But I think what we need to make sure that we give the credit to the people who really have done the fighting from the beginning. And that's, frankly, not just Democrats who all voted against it, not just the two senators on the Republican side who opposed it, but also the activists who have been driving, frankly, the debate in a way that I don't think anyone could have anticipated.
Rich, Isn't this, to some extent, not just an indictment of Republican legislating, but of conservative health policy ideas? Because this process has looked ridiculous. But the reason that they have ended up here is that Republicans in Congress have been completely unable to come up with anything that would be simultaneously good policy in their view and popular with voters if they passed it.
Yeah, well, the problem all along has been there's a faction of the party that doesn't want to repeal Obamacare. There's a faction of the party that doesn't want to replace Obamacare. So when you try to repeal it and replace it, you're going to have a big problem. And I think their ideas from conservative policy wonks that would have avoided a lot of the political problems with this bill, that would have avoided the big coverage problem, that would have avoided the premium spikes, would have avoided potentially leaving people lower down the income scale in the lurch. It's just that Republican politicians either didn't understand them or weren't particularly interested in them or just frankly opposed them. And this skinny bill, which was sort of the last recourse just to keep the process moving, was just the latest iteration of a process that was completely indefensible from the very beginning when Paul Ryan several months ago unveiled this leadership bill and said you have, you know, basically 5 days to review it and vote on it. It's just crazy. And this was the logical fulfillment, the culmination of the craziness, was asking everyone to vote on a bill that no one really supported, and that if it actually became law would have been really bad. That would have knocked people off insurance, led to less coverage, at least according to the CBO, and certainly increased premiums. So you're asking people to vote for something based on the assurance that it wouldn't happen. And that's just puts you in a very awkward position. So this has just been a complete debacle.
To what extent is this failure the president's fault? I mean, Republicans in Congress, I think, have wanted him to engage somewhat more in the substance of the policy, be a messenger about why the bill was actually a good thing, rather than just that Republicans ought to pass it in order to get a win. But obviously, it's Congress's job to legislate, put it on the president's desk, who then gets to decide whether to sign something. It feels like Donald Trump is the root cause of a lot of, or is a cause of a lot of trouble in the Republican Party right now. But this, you know, even Congress, this thing it was supposed to do itself, couldn't manage to do their role.
Well, Trump didn't help and probably hurt a little bit at the margins. And when you're trying to do something this complex and politically difficult just inherently, you want to be firing on all cylinders. And they weren't. And the process issues I just discussed speak to a certain lack of self-confidence in their own position and their own cause. Otherwise, you'd run through the committee hearings. You wouldn't be afraid of a longer debate. You wouldn't be afraid of the publicly airing, you know, these bills for months and taking account of the criticisms and adjusting the way you as you went along. And both Ryan and McConnell were just in a desperate rush, in part because they thought every day that passed they were in a worse political position rather than a better one, and also because of some of the distortions inherent to trying to do this through reconciliation. So I would have voted for the skinny bill. I would have kept the process going. I think having a chance to repeal and replace would have been better than where they are now, and maybe there's still some slender chance, but it doesn't look like it. And McCain, you know, he's being celebrated, at least in most quarters, but this is not what he ever campaigned on, just bipartisan fixes to Obamacare, one. And two, there aren't going to be bipartisan fixes to Obamacare. The Democrats will just insist on further subsidies to prop up the current law with no real reforms.
Yeah, Jamil, what do you make of that? You hear from a lot of both Republicans and Democrats this idea that the next step is to try to look for a bipartisan solution. I have a lot of difficulty coming up with an idea set that seems like it would appeal simultaneously to enough Republicans and Democrats in Congress, even though there is this sort of broad agreement on both sides that the law has some problems that should be addressed.
Indeed. I think that the Democrats, some degree rightly, have shifted to a protectionist stance where they feel that, hey, well, this law's under attack. We need to make sure that it survives. So I know that, you know, perhaps they haven't put forth as many constructive ideas for repairing it the way that it needs to be as maybe they should. But here's the thing. You know, Republicans have had 7 years to come up with constructive ideas on how to repair it. They've had 7 years to think about how to replace it. And yet all we've got is a bill that gives, you know, inordinate tax benefits to the wealthy while, you know, crippling to a large degree, our healthcare system for tens of millions of people. So, you know, let's also consider the fact that John McCain still wants to repeal Obamacare. He made that clear in his statement last night. I think that, you know, when we have John McCain, you know, and other, you know, Lindsey Graham, all the other guys who said that they won't pass this bill, that strategy is just, I'm thankful that, frankly, John McCain came out and said that he's not going to do that, because it was an absolutely baffling strategy. Why would you ever pass a bill that you don't want to see become law? I think what, you know, the Democrats have got right now, aside from, you know, moment of joy, is they've got to shift to a stance where they are protecting against the sabotage of Obamacare from the Trump administration. And that's something that's been clear, that the president has already begun. Honestly, we'll have to see what happens in terms of, like, them being able to repair it. They got to make sure it survives.
Olivia, do you have a sense of where the White House intends to go from here? The president has occasionally made these comments that he would let Obamacare fail. There are things that he can do that his Department of Health and Human Services can do that will interfere with the insurance markets. He's also been throwing his weight around, sort of ham-handedly threatening Republicans in Congress who stood in the way. We had this report that the Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, got on the phone with Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, made a threat about Interior Department doing adverse things to Alaska if she wouldn't come around. In response, Murkowski, who chairs the relevant subcommittee on appropriations that funds the Interior Department, somehow ended up canceling a bunch of meetings to confirm people who would work under Zinke at that department. Do you think that they have an idea about a new strategy here, or is it just going to be sort of making threats and trying to disrupt?
Well, I think from everything that we know about the Trump administration so far, it seems like it will probably be the latter. I mean, they didn't really have a strategy going into this, and I think immediately probably regretted not starting with something like tax reform or with infrastructure instead of this impossible thing that they're trying to do here. I mean, they don't have a plan, and it's incredibly unpopular. And, you know, I think we have to remember that Donald Trump hates almost more than anything else being unpopular and being criticized. And I think it's starting to sort of weigh on him. He's been tremendously unhappy, from everything that I understand, in the White House recently. He hates when his approval numbers keep sinking. He hates seeing critical coverage of himself, and having this failure, a repeated failure, certainly doesn't help with that. So I think probably behind the scenes, they will continue to threaten people. They will continue to do things like that. But I certainly believe that they will probably try to move on to something where they at least have a chance of having success, you know, in the near future.
Rich, what do you think? How dead is Trump care right now?
Well, I think Republican senators will keep talking, and they should. And perhaps, you know, there's some version of skinny repeal plus, with the plus making it a little more substantively coherent and defensible. But it's you know, it'll be highly unlikely, I think, that they come back from this. And, you know, the president will talk about tanking Obamacare by pulling out the subsidies. I think push comes to shove, he's very unlikely to do that, because at least Republicans don't have direct ownership of the current system, which is not in a robustly healthy state. And if Trump were to do that, immediately he would have responsibility for a collapsing system. So I imagine cooler heads will prevail, and the political risks of doing that will be impressed on him, and he won't.
Cooler heads will prevail in the Trump White House.
That would be a first.
Let us know what you think about the surprise save of the Affordable Care Act on our Facebook page, or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker tells us about his profane conversation with Anthony Scaramucci. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page, or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. Later in the show, pollsters Margie O'Meara and Kristen Soltis Anderson will take a look at the new economic agenda announced by congressional Democrats. But first, in addition to the high drama in the Senate, I want to turn to some news at the White House end of Pennsylvania Avenue this week. Late Friday, Trump tweeted that he had hired Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly to replace beleaguered Chief of Staff Reince Priebus. You may recall that last week, Donald Trump hired Anthony Scaramucci to be his new communications director. And you've probably heard that on Wednesday, Scaramucci had a surprisingly candid conversation with a reporter in which Scaramucci insulted top White House colleagues, including Priebus, in sometimes obscene terms. Ryan Lizza is that reporter. He's the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, and he joins us now. Ryan, can you give the highlights of your conversation with the Mooch for some of those who haven't heard it?
Three top lines are he threatened to fire all the communications staffers in the White House if I didn't tell him who my source was for the fact that he was having dinner with Sean Hannity and Donald Trump. He accused the chief of staff, Reince Priebus, of being a paranoid schizophrenic and told me that he had called the FBI to investigate him for leaking confidential information. And he accused the chief strategist to the president, Steve Bannon, of something that I guess the cleanest way to describe on air is auto fellatio. I think those are the three biggies. And then he also sort of had a rambling moment in the conversation where he talked about digital fingerprints and lie detectors. And he was apparently trying to tell me that that's how he was going to root out the leakers in the White House. So those, and then he ended the call saying he had to go because he had to go tweet some stuff to make Reince crazy. And then within a few minutes of getting off the phone, that's exactly what he did.
So that thing you just said where he threatened you that he would fire all the White House communication staffers, that's weird as a threat.
Very weird, because
usually
a threat, you want it to be suffer some kind of consequence on the person you're threatening.
Right. So,
like, if I tell you, Josh, hey, if you don't tell me that information, I am firing my intern, Josh. You better tell me.
Oh, no, that's terrible. But so the reason he was so upset, you had reported that he was out at dinner with Sean Hannity and the president, and he was upset that someone had told you that?
Yeah, yeah. That was what set him off. He called me because he saw that reported, I guess, when he came out of the dinner. And I think some media reporters were asking about it. So he called me and just started right in on who are your sources. And, you know, I said, look, you know, Anthony, I can't tell you that. You know, I can't tell you that. If you tell me something in confidence, I'm not going to go then tell other people what you said. And, you know, we went around in circles on that for a while. And then he just sort of worked himself up into a lather saying that I know it was Reince and this is what's going to happen to Reince and Reince is going to be asked to resign, you know, imminently. And that's sort of where the conversation started. It started with him demanding to know who the sources were for this trivial little scoop I had that I just tweeted because it wasn't even worth its own article. And it launched from there into his criticisms of Reince and Steve Bannon and how Anthony Scaramucci was going to try and get rid of the leakers in the White House.
So the weird thing about this is this seems like an overt campaign, basically, to overthrow the existing regime in the White House to try to make himself chief of staff. Do you think this was a strategic choice that he made to go public with this? Because he tweeted that he made the mistake of trusting you, which would seem to imply that he didn't realize he was on the record with you.
I talked to him yesterday afternoon before the piece posted because I wanted to go over it with him and sort of make sure he knew it was coming. And so, look, the communications director for the White House calls you and asks you a couple of questions, and then you turn it around into an interview. You know, my first concern there is, one, was it on the record? Did we set any ground rules that make it off the record or in background? No. And then, two, was what he said newsworthy and important enough to report? And I certainly think, you know, when the communications director at the White House calls you and tells you that he's firing all his staffers and he's calling the FBI in to investigate the chief of staff, that's fairly newsworthy information. And so all these secondary issues about whether, oh, did he forget to say it was off the record, are pretty meaningless, right? Our jobs as journalists are to get information out of the people who speak for the White House. So especially when, you know, someone calls you up and is a pro, the top white communications official at the White House. There's no ambiguity about whether it's on the record or not. That's a pretty important story to tell.
Do you have a sense that the president is happy or unhappy with this? Obviously, this would be bizarre, easily fireable behavior in a normal organization. But is this what the president wants his communications director doing?
I think that's a great question. Some people said to me yesterday, oh, wow, Anthony Scaramucci is going to get fired for saying all that. And I said, well, maybe he'll get fired or maybe he'll get promoted. You know, it's sort of one or the other in this White House. I have not heard anything definitive that I can report. I did see some sort of loosely sourced quotes in the news today that Trump, you know, loved this. But, I mean, Josh, you know this. With this White House, when you see anonymous stuff, I mean, you know, these guys lie all the time, and they lie anonymously. I've had it done to me. And so you can never really tell if that's just someone who's trying to go to bat for Scaramucci and is leaking that Trump loved this, or if it's someone with actual good information.
Well, we'll see whether or not he's employed there in a week and whether maybe he's employed as chief of staff. Maybe he really will get rid of Reince Priebus.
I mean, right, Brian, this is the great test, right? Does this get you a promotion or firing in the White House? This will teach us a lot.
Ryan Lizza, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Josh.
Okay, I want to bring in our panel to discuss that interview and what it says about how the Trump administration is running the country. That's on the left, Jamil Smith, political journalist and contributing writer at The Daily Beast. On the right, Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And our special guest, Olivia Nuzzi, Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. One funny aspect of this for me is that one of the things that Scaramucci was outraged about being leaked was his financial disclosure form from the work he'd been doing at the Export-Import Bank before he went over to the White House. Now, you'll note it's called a financial disclosure form, and it turns out that the way it actually got out was that Politico contacted the Ex-Im Bank and asked for it through normal channels. It was not a leak. It was a disclosure of a public document. And yet he was super outraged about it. Rich, you mentioned last week that you're friendly with Anthony. Does this sound like the Anthony Scaramucci you know?
He's highly entertaining. And you know, I'm sure Ryan enjoyed that phone call at a certain level. But it's not what you want from a high-level White House official. It's just completely bizarre to think that you can call and browbeat a reporter into giving up his sources, as you pointed out, based on the threat of firing people who work for you, not for the reporter. And also, by the way, it's a sure sign you're writing for The New Yorker if you describe what the phrase that Anthony used for one of his colleagues as auto fellatio. So that's very impressive on the part on Ryan's part. But look, it's completely jaw dropping. It gets more and more bizarre every single week, and who knows what next week holds. But it seems as though, based on most of what happened this week, that Anthony was brought in part to shiv Reince Priebus. And this is kind of goes in the Sessions category. This is just a rotten way to treat anyone. If Trump doesn't want Reince to be chief of staff anymore, call him in and say, hey, you're fired. It didn't work out. Thank you very much for what you've done. Instead of this Byzantine campaign of humiliation against the guy. And it speaks to a weakness and an inability to handle kind of personal conflict at any level. That's really astonishing.
Olivia, what's this first week of Scaramucci's reign at the White House been like? There had been this sense that maybe he would start a reset with the press. He has put the daily briefings back on television. He seems to like talking to reporters. Maybe this is an episode that shows he likes talking to reporters too much. Are reporters pleased about this?
Well, it definitely did reset things. I don't think in quite the way that the White House had anticipated. But I want to point out a couple different things here. Number one, yes, he said that the cameras are back on, but there have only been two on-camera briefings this week. And so I want to be really clear about that. It's not as though we're having this like unprecedented moment in recent history of transparency with the White House. But also, you know, I've noted this a couple of times. You were asking if it sounded like, you know, the Anthony Scaramucci that Rich knows. There is this sort of pervasive thing in Trump's orbit with people who just cannot conceive of the fact that reporters may be reporting, and that's how they obtain information. They think that every story is the result of a leak or the result of opposition research. It doesn't occur to them that reporters may obtain documents, that reporters may have their own sources who they coax information out of. And so that kind of contributes to this paranoia that is pulsing through the West Wing, and even more so now that Anthony is in the White House. And recall, you know, he was under the impression, rightly or wrongly, I don't know, that Reince Priebus was responsible for him not getting a job in the first place back in the winter. And so he's had this sort of bitterness towards Reince Priebus since then. And, you know, I have not confirmed that that's why he was brought in to do away with Reince. But I don't think it's the most outrageous thing in the world. I wrote a story recently about how Trump really does have a hard time firing people who are very close to him and working alongside him in this White House.
Jamil, this is obviously an entertaining story, and people have been very focused on the obscenities and whatnot. But as Ryan noted, there are really interesting, important, substantive things that came out of this conversation. The threat to fire basically everybody in the White House comms operation, claiming that he's dealing directly with the FBI, trying to get them to investigate his enemies in the West Wing, accusing the chief of staff of crimes. It feels like we should worry about a hot-headed lunatic being so close to the president, maybe being promoted to be White House chief of staff.
Yeah, and a Bulgarian to represent a Bulgarian is not necessarily a good thing. I mean, one of the phrases that Scaramucci used it was particularly troubling to me when he said to Ryan that this is a major catastrophe for the American country. So I'm asking you as an American patriot to give me a sense of who leaked it. What is he talking about? It's a major catastrophe that Ryan tweeted about a dinner with Sean Hannity and Bill Shine. It's a major catastrophe that, you know, we now know that Scaramucci hasn't divested from his financial holdings. These are things that American voters should know about. These are things that actually matter. And the fact that he would freak out to this extent over a tweet about a dinner gives me real pause about what these guys will do when a real catastrophe strikes. Let's keep in mind it's hurricane season right now. At some point, these folks are going to have to deal with a major humanitarian crisis on our shores, and they don't seem like they're up to the task.
In addition to this war, inside the West Wing, there are at least three major cabinet secretaries whose relationships with President Trump are under strain. Rex Tillerson went on vacation this week amid tensions between him and the White House over the Iran deal and other matters. Defense Secretary James Mattis was reportedly appalled by the president's choice to announce via Twitter his ban on transgender military service. And in fact, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has sent out a memo saying he's not going to do anything about the guidance in the tweet until he gets formal guidance from Mattis. And then, of course, we have Trump's continuing war on Jeff Sessions, saying this week that he's disappointed in the attorney general, but not committing to keep him on or fire him. Why don't we start with the trans ban? Olivia, do you have a sense of why the president did this now in this manner on Twitter?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation about it, that it was a deflection. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders' initial response to it, I think the story from the White House has changed a little bit since it first happened, but was that President Trump just made the decision and he thought it was fine to announce it without first figuring out any of the specifics and the logistics of how it would work. And it does seem possible. I mean, not that we should trust anything that comes out of the White House press office based on their history, but it does seem possible that he did just make the decision on a whim, that it wasn't the result of any kind of broader calculation, any type of big debate among the staff or people who advise him. I don't know. I haven't seen any definitive answer about what exactly led to it.
Rich, what have you made of the fact that he's come under so much criticism on Capitol Hill for this from Republicans, not just from moderates? I've been surprised, Orrin Hatch, Joni Ernst, Richard Shelby, quite conservative members of the Senate, saying that they oppose this move to push transgender people out of the military.
Well, one, it reflects the process, which, of course, is appalling on any level, even if you support this policy. This is not the way to announce it and go about implementing it. And two, the politics of this issue have moved. And, we have an Orrin Hatch out there not just criticizing the tweet as a tweet, but criticizing the actual substance of the policy. It's a strong sign of that.
Do you think that they're in the right, that transgender people ought to be able to serve in the military?
I need to look at the merits of it more. The military does ban people based on all sorts of conditions. I have a friend who knows someone. He's a vet, and his son is signing up for ROTC and was once on Ritalin. And you can't sign up if you're on Ritalin, in theory, although it's waivable. So I think something like that arrangement might make sense on the issue of transgender, which can be associated, you know, with depression and anxiety. So more kind of a case-by-case approach probably makes sense rather than this ban. And certainly going and hunting down people who are currently transgendered in the military to root them out and keeping with such a policy would be perverse.
Jamil, what do you make of the response from the Joint Chiefs? Now, it's clear that, you know, the president blindsided at least most of the people in the Pentagon. The White House says that it did consult with Mattis, but it certainly didn't go through reviews. The Pentagon was doing its own review of transgender service. But I'm a little unnerved by the sort of response basically saying, you know, well, this statement from the president isn't in order, and we're going to wait to hear from the Secretary of Defense. It feels to me like I wouldn't want more broadly the military sort of asserting its ability to pick and choose which instructions from the president it has to follow.
Well, at the same time, though, the manner in which they get those instructions matters. I mean, do we pay attention to a tweet? Do we pay attention to something he says in an interview? These things have to be, you know, these things have to have processes. And I agree with them saying, you know what, let's take a minute. Let's find out exactly if we're going to get these orders in the manner in which we are accustomed to getting these orders, and then make an assessment from there. Now, just to Rich's point, though, I mean, I think it needs to be said that, you know, transgender people are not folks who are dependent upon a particular drug or folks who, you know, may have some kind of other disqualifying part of their lives that makes them unsuitable for military duty. There are tens of thousands of transgender officers, sailors, and Marines currently in service right now in the field. And the notion that they are being told that something may be wrong with them is wrong. And I think what we need to make sure we do is when we talk about this, we talk about it from the standpoint that this is discrimination. Period. It is nothing more than that. And we have to, you know, we have to basically decide whether or not we're going to be okay with that.
You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider. I've been talking with Jamil Smith of The Daily Beast, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Olivia Nuzzi of New York Magazine. When we come back, Susan Hennessy of the Lawfare blog will talk about what legally prevents Trump from interfering in the Russia investigation. We'll be right back.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. President Trump is upset that Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from the Russia investigation. And it's clear he's upset because that means Sessions is unable to interfere with the investigation. So for our In Focus segment this week, I want to discuss a topic that may soon become very relevant: the legal strictures that bind or do not bind Trump in his war with his own Justice Department. For that, I'm joined by Susan Hennessy of the Brookings Institution and the Lawfare blog. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Josh.
So let's suppose Trump stops whining and actually goes ahead and fires Jeff Sessions. What effect could that have on the investigation?
Well, so for the moment, Jeff Sessions is recused from the Russia investigation. Robert Mueller has been appointed a special counsel over the matter. And so sort of in the immediate, it doesn't have an immediate impact on the way that investigation is going to move forward. Now, it depends on the identity of the person that he decides to either nominate for the attorney general or who becomes the acting attorney general when Jeff Sessions leaves, and whether or not that person is inclined to somehow interfere with the Russia investigation.
So the acting attorney general thing is interesting because ordinarily the deputy attorney general, who is Rod Rosenstein, who appointed Mueller in the first place, would become acting attorney general if Jeff Sessions were to leave. So presumably Rosenstein would not be inclined to fire the special counsel who he hired. But I guess the president has a fair bit of flexibility to make somebody else the acting attorney general if he wants.
Right. So, of course, Congress has quite a bit of control here. So they've already expressed very, very strong displeasure with the public criticism of Jeff Sessions and with any notion that he would be fired, particularly for these sort of politically motivated reasons, so that they could make it very difficult for Trump to appoint and confirm a new attorney general who was more sort of amenable to his views here. You know, absent actually nominating a new attorney general and confirming them, you'd either have the ordinary order of succession at the Justice Department Department, which would be Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein acting, and then below that, Associate Attorney General Rachel Brand, who would sort of step up depending on whether or not individuals recuse themselves. There's also the possibility under the Vacancies Reform Act that Trump could just select another Senate-confirmed individual to serve for a particular period of time. These are technically all live legal possibilities, but he would really be staring down Congress on this issue that has expressed its displeasure. You know, Lindsey Graham has already said that, efforts to fire Sessions, or maybe he was Mueller, he was talking about, could be the beginning of the end of Trump's presidency. So they are taking this latest round of rhetoric really quite seriously.
So what else could Congress do? I mean, they've said that they won't confirm somebody else, but if the president installs some person who is very loyal to him personally as the acting attorney general, and that person fires Mueller or tries to shut down the investigation, what would you look for Congress to do to try to stop that?
Well, look, I mean, it seems dramatic, but sort of the ultimate remedy here is the political remedy of impeachment, right? So there are certain things that that Congress might be able to do through appropriations or authorizations to sort of control the Justice Department. But ultimately, what we're concerned about here is whether or not the President of the United States respects the rule of law and sort of the principle of independent law enforcement. And so if Trump takes these really very dramatic steps to demonstrate that he holds views that are essentially sort of antithetical to the basic American values here, it should not be surprising if Congress then decides that, you know, this is the moment in which to undertake, you know, really pretty dramatic remedies.
There's a set of norms and policies that govern the way that the White House interacts with the Justice Department around investigations. They're really not supposed to tell the Justice Department what to investigate. There are only a few people in the White House who are supposed to talk to only a few people in the Justice Department when that's necessary. And both Trump and Anthony Scaramucci have been talking openly about violating those norms. Scaramucci saying that he was reaching out to the FBI to get them to investigate Reince Priebus. Obviously, we all heard about Trump's dinner with James Comey, where he asked him to lay off Mike Flynn. To what extent is any of this stuff illegal, or is it really just a series of norms that we had about maintaining the independence of investigations that Trump is fully within his legal power to ignore?
Well, so it's certainly more than norms. There are formal Justice Department and White House policies that govern the way these communications are supposed to take place. Now, there's a different question as to whether or not the president can violate them versus a staffer like Scaramucci. That said, the reason why these rules exist is essentially a normative one, and that is an independent Department of Justice. Now, we know that the White House and the president needs to have some communication with his attorney general on sort of broad policy issues. There's lots of important and appropriate things in which those two individuals would need to have communication. But where we draw the line is whenever there's any sorts of communications regarding specific investigations, ongoing criminal investigations. And the reason for that is because we would never want even the appearance of the White House directing the Attorney General of the Justice Department to investigate or prosecute someone for political reasons as opposed to just their assessment on professionals regarding what the law requires. So that's really what we're seeing here is, pretty blatant calls for the prosecution of political opponents.
Finally, I want to get your opinion on what we were discussing earlier about the president's tweet on a transgender ban in the military. What do you make of this question of whether a tweet is in order and whether the Joint Chiefs have to just, take something the president says on Twitter and figure out how to implement it?
Yeah, so I think we really should be pretty cautious here. I've seen people sort of cheering the notion of, that Dunford's letter means there's some sort of insubordination or ignoring an order. That certainly isn't what's happening here, and we shouldn't want to see that happening. The presidents say all kinds of things, maybe not ordinarily in tweets, but, Obama, Clinton, other presidents have made comments or statements in speeches and interviews and elsewhere. We don't see the military immediately jump into action. Instead, what they do is they wait for an executive order or a similar decree to be issued so they know exactly what the president meant because he can speak to them with a level of clarity that's certainly far more than 140 characters. So really what we see the chairman of the Joint Chiefs coming back and saying is, look, he made a sort of a broad policy statement. We don't know what that means. Actually implementing this policy, which could lead to the discharge of between 2 and 10,000 service members, we need more formal guidance for this. And so we're going to wait for the formal guidance to come in. I think odds are that The likelihood is where we end up at the end of all of this is where we began, which is that currently transgender service members are allowed to serve. However, there's a policy regarding recruits that's still under study right now. Secretary Mattis has requested more time for that study to be complete before accepting transgender recruits. You know, so I think in all likelihood we'll end up somewhere pretty similar to where we are right now. But if we're going to move the needle on that policy at all, we're talking about months of paperwork, months of studies, and that begins not with a tweet, but with an executive order.
Thank you very much, Susan.
Thanks for having me.
Now we're going to go to a segment we're calling It's Been Busy. The idea is we've all been so busy talking about the latest shocking developments in the news that we often don't get to focus on some of the really important things that have been happening. So this week, something that got buried under all that other news was Democrats in Congress announcing a new platform focused on economic issues, which they're calling A Better Deal. It focuses on handing power back to consumers and workers. For example, they want the government to block more corporate mergers so that workers have more power to bargain wages up and consumers have more power to get prices down. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says one of Democrats' big problems in the 2016 election was that they did not offer voters a clear proposition on making the economy work for them, and this is his effort to change that. I'm joined now by two pollsters who will help us understand whether Schumer is right. Do Democrats need a positive economic message to win, or can they just focus on Trump being bad? On the left is Democratic pollster Margie O'Meara. She's the executive vice president at PSB Research. And on the right is Republican pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson. She's a columnist for The Washington Examiner and co-founder of Echelon Insights. Margie, what do you make of this? Do Democrats need a positive agenda? And does this one sound like it will work with voters?
Well, the short answer is yes, Democrats need a positive agenda. There was a Washington Post ABC poll from a week or so ago that showed that a majority of Americans feel that Democrats really stand for the Democratic Party, stands more against Trump than for something. And that's something that Democratic candidates have as a challenge, for sure. The fact that there is so much news this week and how dominant that news can be just reinforces the challenge that Democrats, with a strong message, as I believe the Better Deal message is, any strong message is going to be drowned out by what's going on from the White House. What's going on from the White House is so unprecedented. It's so outrageous. It is so relentless that it's impossible for really any other news, even from within the White House, to get out. The White House can't even get news out, given what's going on from the president. So that is one of the challenges, and that would be a challenge regardless of the kind of messaging that Democrats would put out.
Kristen, are you concerned that this messaging is going to work for Democrats?
I'm not terribly concerned. I think it's interesting, though, to think back to 8 years ago. As we headed into the 2010 midterm elections, you had Democrats in the White House and Republicans seeking to take back control of a chamber of Congress. In that case, you had this debate that I think still lingers about what was the reason why Republicans were able to take back the House. Was it because John Boehner ran on an agenda that he called the Pledge to America? That he had been asking, where are the jobs? Or is it because you had the Tea Party movement stand up and say, no more bailouts, no more Obamacare, no more spending? There is an argument to be made that Republicans did well in 2010 because they were asking this where are the jobs question and trying to put forward a positive agenda. But I think the more compelling argument is they stood up against the Obama administration, and enough people wanted to apply a brake pedal to what they saw was a rapidly accelerating agenda of the left being implemented. The question, though, is there a rapidly accelerating agenda of the right being implemented? And given the failure of the skinny repeal, the failure of Republicans to do anything about Obamacare, there may be a question of whether or not voters actually want a brake pedal applied to a car that's already seemingly parked on the side of the road. If Republicans in Congress are not doing much of anything either, then we would like to stop things more may not be as compelling an argument. They may need to be out there putting forward a positive agenda of their own to explain what they would achieve or try to achieve with a President Trump in order to get things done.
And it also really shows, too, that an effort to try to mend what is happening. I mean, what is happening with this toxicity in Congress that people of both parties really find, or voters of both parties, policies find sad and depressing, right? And so having a positive agenda is something that that can show, look, we're trying to move beyond that. We're trying to really get something done. And it doesn't mean that every Democratic candidate running for any office has to sign on to, you know, every single component of what's been released. This is really a platform and the beginning of a conversation that will need repetition and strong candidates and all the things that are you need to be successful in campaigning.
I want to bring back in Jamil Smith, our left panelist on this week's show. Jamil, when we have conversations about this and the Democratic economic agenda, it sort of often ends up in this frame of a question of, do Democrats need to go on economic issues and try to win back working class white voters that they lost? Or do they need to focus on what people sometimes refer to as identity politics, trying to appeal to a coalition of minority groups? It doesn't seem to me like that necessarily has to be a binary, even though it often ends up being one. Do you see this as ending up sort of down on the side of that issue as being going back to the working class whites?
I think the Democrats are missing an incredible opportunity here. I think what they're doing is falling into this old line of thinking that class issues are purely class and they have nothing to do with race or gender or any other identifying characteristic. In an age in which intersectionality is more and more important in our politics, they seem to, you know, just be doing a reactionary, you know, policy that, you know, putting forth a reactionary policy that is not going to actually address the issues inherent in the economic inequalities that we see throughout our culture. Now, we see abortion as an economic issue. If we see immigration as an economic issue, those are, you know, that's a selling point. That's something that's going to touch both sides of that argument. It's going to, you know, get in, you know, the folks who are out here dealing with these inequalities that are, you know, systematic. They're going to realize that the Democrats are fighting for them. And also perhaps these, you know, these white working class voters who think that, you know, the Democratic Party has abandoned them, they'll understand that these policies benefit them too. They have, you know, by putting forth this plan, signal that they are reacting in exactly the wrong way to the advancement of Trump. He wants a culture war and he's going to fight it. They seem to be wanting to sit it out.
Margie, what do you make of that?
I understand exactly those concerns. I do want a Democratic message that is inclusive of everybody. And I agree with your premise, Josh, that it doesn't need to be binary, that we can have and we have had Democratic candidates who appeal to a wide variety of voters rather than slice and dice voters in a way where, you know, some people are getting some message and some people are getting another message. My understanding of this document is this meant to be an economic policy to fill what the perception that there was a void in what Democrats are proposing in terms of economic policies. And when the conversation about the inclusiveness and how and pushing off against what's coming out of the White House in terms of a lack of inclusiveness is a conversation that can happen concurrently, simultaneously. But, you know, that's how I see what this platform is designed to do. But I hear that. And that's a conversation that Democrats have all the time, a regular basis, and, you know, seemingly without a real clear a satisfying resolution in sight. But I'm optimistic that that going forward in the heat of an election battle and in the next presidential race, that we can do all of those things as a party and we can appeal to a wide variety of people. We've done it before, and I think we can do it again.
The polls suggest that economic issues are the area where President Trump has the strongest hand to play. And in fact, Politico reported that just yesterday, a group of Democratic pollsters presented some research to House Majority PAC. It's a Democratic PAC trying to win back the House, saying that in a lot of these sort of white working class areas, they were finding Donald Trump winning versus the Democrats on issues of jobs and the economy by 30 plus point margins. These are enormous. And it's a lot of these districts in the upper Midwest, in upstate New York. These are the types of places that if Democrats are going to take back the House, they would need to win those districts. Now, Republicans have a separate challenge where in many sort of suburban upscale districts, they may be facing a challenge in the midterms. But certainly Democrats' path back to taking the House back will have to go through a lot of areas with a lot of white working class voters who may not even love Donald Trump's tweeting, may not care as much about the culture war fights, but think that he's going to do a good job for them on the economy.
Kristen Soltis Anderson and Margie O'Meara, thank you for joining us. And we have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Olivia Nuzzi, what's your rant?
generally, I talked about it a little bit earlier, but I'm just very tired of people describing everything as sexist. You know, if everything is viewed in terms of whether or not it's sexist, even when that should not be on the table in the discussion, then when actual sexist things do happen, then it's much more difficult for people to point them out and to take them seriously. We see this a lot, people calling things that aren't harassment, harassment. It's so annoying, and it's distracting, and it's kind of simplistic way to debate anything.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, is paid not to tell the truth about school choice, but she outdid herself last week when she alleged school choice is, quote, the polite cousin of segregation. This is completely perverse, given that it's overwhelmingly minority parents who are desperate to use vouchers and charters to get their kids out of de facto segregated and failing public schools. For shame.
Jamil Smith, what's your rant?
I'll just note off of Rich's note that the NAACP did announce this week that charter schools are not a substitute for public education improvement. But my rant has to deal with the Ferguson Community Empowerment Center that opened this week on the site of the Quick Trip gas station that had been burned and looted during the 2014 protests. The work goes beyond the spectacle that we see on cable news, the fires, the property damage. These communities are actually trying to rebuild themselves and succeeding. So I think that should be noted.
For my rant, I want to leave you with something that former Obama speechwriter John Lovett said on Twitter this week, which is, it's not more sophisticated to be too cynical and pleasantly surprised than to be too optimistic and let down. It's been easy to assume the worst out of Washington, and a lot of people on the left have assumed that the Republicans in Congress were going to find some way to do something terrible on health care. But this week, enough of them chose not to do it, and they chose not to do it because the fundamentals worked. The healthcare bill was terrible policy and terrible politics, and the threat of engaging in terrible policy and politics and being punished for it is what caused Republicans to fumble their way into not passing it. John McCain set himself up as the fall guy. He voted out of order so that he, not Lisa Murkowski, would be the deciding vote to the cheers of his Democratic colleagues. But I suspect a lot of Republicans in the Senate were cheering on the inside. A lot of them wanted Trump Care to die, but they did not want to be seen by the base as the person who had murdered it. So John McCain put himself out there on the limb so that the others could survive. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Jamil Smith, Olivia Nuzzi, Ryan Lizza, Susan Hennessy, and the pollsters, Margie Omero and Kristen Soltis Anderson. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. Todd M. Simon composed our new theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.